Ahoy mateys, and welcome to drop number 8 of the Oceans Podcast, the show that shares the experiences, wisdom, and knowledge from a variety of different mermaids and mermen. My name's Josh Tebbett, and I'll be your skipper navigating you through the show. Bordered by the Great Barrier Reef and the island arcs of Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and New Caledonia, the Coral Sea contains the highest area of high biodiversity coral reef remaining in the world. Our guest on the show today is one of the most skilled and widely travelled ecotourism professionals in the Indo-Pacific region, with a strong background in small ship adventure cruising and a PhD in coral reef ecology from James Cook University. His passion for the reefs, islands, and people of the South Pacific region is tangible. That passion drives the development of the Coral Sea Foundation as a platform for delivering his vision for sustainable reef management and the ultimate marine ecotourism experience. We discuss coral stresses and the impact of climate change on the reef systems, how we can have a positive effect on the reef, the need to switch over to renewable energy sources, as well as briefly touching on plastics in the ocean. This episode is absolutely jam-packed with jewels of knowledge and insights into the coral sea, how fragile it is, and why it's too precious to lose. So without further ado, Dr. Andy Lewis, welcome to the Ocean Podcast.
Thanks, Josh. Very nice to be here.
Thank you so much for having me. We're in tropical far north Queensland on Magnetic Island. It's a beautiful sunny day outside, and we're trying to avoid the heat. So let's just dive straight into it. Andy, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your growing up?
Sure. The eldest of four kids. Dad was a civil engineer, and my mum did home duties and was also very heavily involved in, you know, social activities. I grew up in Western Australia mainly until I was about 10 years old, and then just before my 11th birthday moved up to the northwest of WA. All through that time we had a pretty strong connection to the ocean, lots of boating, sailing, windsurfing, snorkeling, fishing. I moved to Melbourne for the last couple of years of my high school, so in the mid-1980s, and then once I graduated high school, I came up to James Cook University straight out of year 12 and did the marine biology program at JCU. So I went right through undergraduate, double major in marine biology and organic chemistry. I worked for a year in the chem lab extracting natural products out of marine organisms and testing them for potential biological activity. And then I did honours in marine biology in 91, looking at cephalopods and reproduction in cephalopods. And then started a PhD in 92. And so spent the next 3.5 years diving on the Great Barrier Reef, looking at coral reefs and the dynamics of the communities of fish and other animals out there, and then particularly how they responded to disturbance. So when I finished that degree, I set up my own consultancy, and then have been doing a range of ecotourism and sort of scientific consultancies since that time. So that's sort of a natural progression. It's led me towards the formation of the Coral Sea Foundation and the work that we're doing now.
Fantastic. Such a great story to have. And you can obviously see just by reading and listening to interviews you've had, you've got this great passion for the ocean. Did that develop over time, or do you feel like you were just sparked initially by the ocean and then that was your path you had to go towards?
I was always interested in biology. My paternal grandparents were both very keen amateur ornithologists and botanists. And in fact, my great-grandfather on my father's side was the first head of the Fisheries and Game Department in Victoria. So there was a strong sort of ethic of interest in the natural world and in conservation through my family. I actually, in my formative years, thought I would probably end up studying birds. I mean, they were my main passion and interest when I was younger. But we always lived near the sea. So, you know, I mean, I was surfing from age 6 or 7, windsurfing from 11. You know, we always had boats. And I guess the light bulb moment was about halfway through year 12 when I heard through a family friend of another guy that had gone and studied marine biology at JCU. And at that point, I was pretty keen to get out of Melbourne and get back to the tropics. And that was the point where I suddenly went, okay, you know, that's what I need to be doing.
Let's talk about some of the more interesting or fascinating experiences, maybe some of the more memorable experiences you've had over time. Do you want to share with us maybe one or two?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, the number of amazing experiences in the underwater worlds, I mean, it's hard to count. I mean, I've been very, very fortunate in my career of being able to dive just about everywhere around the whole Indo-Pacific, not just Australia, but Indonesia, New Guinea, all around the Solomons. And, you know, I think some of those moments diving solo, during my PhD, just down there on my own and seeing things happening underwater that I'd never seen before or had an idea that were happening. I had an opportunity to get in the water with a tropical killer whale in Papua New Guinea, just off the Ross El Lagoon, which was pretty amazing to be in the water with that animal and get some footage of it. We also swam with leatherback turtles in the Solomons that were feeding, you know, in water 400 meters deep off Morobo Lagoon. And, you know, we got some footage there that no one had ever seen before. I mean, no one had seen those animals feeding in the tropics before. So that was pretty groundbreaking. But I think some of the most incredible moments have actually been connecting with the Melanesian people in PNG and the Solomons, and these people that have got millennia of connection to this environment and this country and have lived there their whole lives. They understand the forest, they understand the reefs. They're living a very sort of simple subsistence lifestyle. I think connecting with those people and hearing their stories and getting their insights into the marine world has been some of the highlight moments. And having meetings with people and talking about marine conservation and having community leaders in tears saying, you know, wow, you've opened our eyes to the fact that we need to be looking after these reefs a little bit better. And because you've done that, here's a house, you know, got given a house on Ferguson Island, you know, on the edge of the rainforest with a waterfall on one way and the Solomon Sea and reefs on the other. And, you know, as a marine biologist, you don't make a huge amount of money, you know, you always have a dream of having a beautiful tropical house somewhere, and suddenly you arrive in this place in a village with people that have nothing, and they say, okay, in return for you helping us out, here's a house. So some of those moments have been really very, very special.
That's beautiful. I love the way you not only incorporate the marine life, but also the people, because at the end of the day, everything's connected, and the people that are in those places can have a great impact onto protecting their surrounding areas, really influencing what's going on in their areas.
It applies not just in Australia, but especially in Melanesia. I mean, if we want to solve this problem of slowing down and reversing the degradation of coral reefs, the answer 100% lies with people. I mean, yes, we need to keep understanding the science of how these reefs are working, but if we want to save them or give them a chance, it's now 100% about dealing with people and how we interact with those reefs. And nowhere more so than Melanesia, where people are depending on those reefs for food. It's their food source. It's their traditional area. I've sat in villages and flashed up images of fishes on the reef to the local people. Every single one of them, they had a local name for. The youngest kids, the women, the dads, everybody knew the names of those fish. You know, a much, much better knowledge than we would have in this country unless you were a trained marine biologist. So it's absolutely about people.
G'day everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, then please check us out online, coralseafoundation.net. There's lots of other interviews there, some amazing imagery. Our YouTube channel has lots of incredible video, and stay in touch with what we're doing.
Okay, well, let's just do a little bit of basic coral theory or anatomy or whatever you want to call it.
Mm.
For those listening that don't have a great understanding of coral, can you explain what coral is?
Coral's an animal. It's in the phylum Cnidaria, which also includes the jellyfish, the anemones, and then all the coral-like animals, the soft corals and the hard corals. That group of animals has been around on Earth for hundreds of millions of years. It's one of the original sort of phyla, I guess, that evolved very early on. So they've got a very long fossil record. Coral itself is a colonial animal. If you imagine a jellyfish sitting upside down in a cup made of calcium carbonate with its tentacles waving around in the water, I mean, that's effectively what a coral polyp is. And then you imagine that thing cloning itself and making thousands and thousands of copies of itself, and they're all connected together on one skeleton. That's essentially what a coral is doing. The really significant and important evolutionary innovation that they did was that they worked out a way to take up an algae out of the seawater, inoculate their tissues with it, and therefore sitting in the sunlight in these shallow tropical reefs, they're able to use that algae to make sugars through photosynthesis, and then those sugars from that algae get translocated over to the coral. So the coral, I mean, that's why these reefs are growing so abundantly in these beautiful, clear tropical waters. They're solar powered. They're running mostly on the energy of the sun via a symbiosis with these algae inside their tissues. So, yeah, without that symbiosis, the modern reefs as we know them probably wouldn't exist. And that symbiosis is
critically important to understand the effects of bleaching on reefs. So it's still an area of very, very important study, and a lot of people are devoting a lot of time to try and work out exactly what's going on in that relationship and why it starts to break down when water temperatures get too warm.
Perfect. So that's a great topic to switch over to.
Mm.
In terms of bleaching, a lot of people hear this, but they may not be aware of exactly what's going on. So can you describe what is happening when coral bleaches?
Yeah, so those algae that are inside the coral tissues are producing sugars, as I said, and that's a chemical reaction. And like any chemical reaction, the speed of that reaction increases as the temperature increases up until a certain point. If the temperature gets too hot, that reaction starts to break down, and then instead of producing beneficial sugars for the coral, those algae start to produce some chemical compounds which are stressful or even toxic to the coral. And at that point, the coral can eject most of those algae out of its tissues. At that point, the coral appears very pale. The calcium carbonate skeleton underneath is white. The coral tissue is a very, very thin, transparent layer over the top. The algae give it a light brown color. And then if there's any other color, like a purple or a blue or a green, that's pigment that's in the coral tissue. So when those algae are ejected, particularly if the coral is basically a brown color, what you'll see is it looks like the coral turns white. At that point, it's still alive. And if the water temperature comes back down below that critical threshold quite quickly, the coral can take up its algae again and there won't be many long-term deleterious effects. However, if that water temperature stays elevated for quite a long time, then the coral starts to get stressed, its immune system starts to suffer, it's not getting the energy that it needs, and then eventually it can get attacked by bacteria or fungi, and then it may well succumb and it may well show mortalities. So when there's a bleaching event, there's a few key quantitative bits of information that as marine biologists we're always interested in. The first one is what proportion of corals are actually showing signs of bleaching, because one of the things we've found is that there's different susceptibilities within corals to bleaching stress. In a given bleaching event, some corals may bleach and die, some corals may bleach and recover, and others may not even bleach. And again, we're still not exactly sure why those things are going on. That's an area of active research. So the first metric is what proportion of the corals bleached and what coral taxa bleached. The second important metric is of those ones that bleached, how many went on to die. So for example, in the big bleaching event that affected the Great Barrier Reef in 1998, around Magnetic Island, we had about 90% of the coral colony showing bleaching, but only 10% died. At the Palm Islands, just 60, 70 kilometres to the north, they also had 90% bleaching, but they had about 60% mortality. So those patterns of mortality and bleaching can vary quite a lot over quite short time, over quite short distances. So they're the sort of the two key things that we need to know. The big bleaching event that affected the Great Barrier Reef in 2016, 2017, caused a lot of mortality, particularly in the susceptible corals, and the main area of mortality was sort of from Port Douglas right up to the tip of Cape York, and it was mainly concentrated on the mid-shelf reefs. The outer-shelf reefs didn't suffer as high a mortality, but the mid-shelf reefs, the water was extra hot, and that's where we saw the main parts of the mortality.
You've got an almost bathtub effect where the mid-range corals are right in that band of, I guess, the really hot water, and the stuff that's a bit further out is controlled by that large body of ocean water, sort of regulating the temperature a bit more, but the shallow stuff really gets hammering.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, so in some bleaching events, for example, there's very strong depth-related mortality patterns. So, you know, you may see a lot of mortality just in the top 3 or 4 metres, or it may go down to 5 or 6 metres, but generally, in most cases, deeper corals in some cases can survive. In a really bad bleaching event, the mortality might go all the way down to 30 metres. So, yeah, there's lots of local scale effects which can play into what's going on there in the bleaching event.
And what sort of other stresses can be placed on these corals?
There's a whole range of different ones. I mean, sediment is another big one, of course. I mean, when sediment lands on a coral colony, the colony has to spend some energy to produce mucus to slough that sediment off, apart from the fact that the sediment's also blocking the light coming into the coral. So sediment and sedimentation plays a role. The nutrients and the heavy metals and whatever else is coming off our mainland that's adhering to those sediment particles also plays a role. So, I mean, studies have shown that, for example, sediments that are coming off catchments that have a high amount of agricultural and or industrial activity, those sediments are more toxic to corals than ones that are coming out of a pristine catchment. So nutrient and nutrient quality generally in the water is something that's also can affect corals in different ways. Some corals do a little bit better if there's a bit more nutrient, but by and large, nutrient also changes the dynamic between coral and algae. So if there's more nutrient, algae may grow quicker and there may be a smothering effect on the reef. So these are the main things that we're sort of looking at, certainly on the Great Barrier Reef.
Okay, and there's another topic that's being brought to case, and that's the effect of acidifications of the ocean.
Mm.
What sort of impact will that have on corals?
The thing that happens with the reason that acidification is happening is that as our carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are being elevated, now up to 415 parts per million over a long run average in our Holocene period of about 280. So there's been a significant increase so far. That CO2 dissolves into the ocean. It changes the chemistry, the complex chemistry of the carbonate, which the corals are using to secrete their skeleton. So again, there's some very, very complex chemistry going in there. The ocean is still alkaline, but it's slowly getting a bit less alkaline and coming down towards the acidic realm. It's not yet in the acidic realm. So that's, again, one thing that a point of, I guess, scientific pedanticness that needs to be addressed is that people talk about ocean acidification. It's actually a decrease in alkalinity. But from a practical point of view, what it means is that the chemical reaction where the coral takes up calcium ions from the seawater and secretes them as a crystalline aragonite skeleton, that chemical process it's harder for that process to occur as the alkalinity of the seawater is declining. And so we've seen that in terms of numerous studies now which have shown declines in calcification rates, particularly in big old corals. And there's been a lot of research done now on other organisms, larval fish, larval invertebrates, looking at the effects of those changes in acidification. And it's important that people understand that coral reefs have not always been present on Earth. In fact, there's been more times when coral reefs haven't been present than there's been times when they have been present. And if you look back through the fossil record, there's been 5 major mass extinction events which have affected the ocean. And in every one of those, coral reefs died out. And in every one of those events, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere were elevated. So there's a pretty strong precedent that says that if we really keep pushing carbon dioxide levels up above 1,000 parts per million, apart from the temperature effects, we're also going to be potentially affecting virtually everything in the ocean that relies on a carbonate skeleton. So that's just not corals, that's all of our crustaceans, our prawns, lobsters, seafood, most of the echinoderms. So it's another quite serious aspect of what we're doing to the global system at the moment that people need to be aware of.
It sort of seems like we're leading down this path now, chatting about coral stresses and the impacts that we're having on corals. I want to move on to now the formation of the Coral Sea Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this whole idea come up, and did you find the necessity for it, or was it just something you felt to be compelled to do?
I spent about a decade doing ecotourism operations, not just around Northern Australia, but right around the arc of the Coral Triangle. So from Indonesia, through Raja Ampat, through Cendrawasih Bay, through the Bismarck Sea of PNG, and out to the Solomons, and that area of the Eastern Coral Triangle now contains the last great tract of high biodiversity reef left in the world. The western end of the Coral Triangle, the Philippines, Indonesian end, has about 170 million people living in it now. A lot of the reefs there, if they're not in a marine protected area, have been quite severely degraded, overfished or bomb fished or, you name it. The eastern end, however, the PNG and the Solomon's end, only 8 million people. And through my decade of traveling around there, photographing, my image library is now over 60,000 images, nearly 200 sites all throughout that area. The thing that really came home to me is, firstly, the reefs there are by and large still in quite good condition. Secondly, they didn't bleach in 2016 and 2017. So their relative value skyrocketed. The third thing is, though, that there's almost no marine protected areas in place in those countries. The governments of those countries don't have the money to do a top-down marine protection program like we can in Australia, where we can have aircraft, we can have patrol boats, we can have the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, all federally funded, all managing these reefs from the top down. Nothing like that exists in PNG or the Solomons. And furthermore, the local people are still living out in these areas. They have ownership of these areas. And if you want to do anything in terms of marine conservation in these areas, it has to happen through engagement with the local people at a grassroots level out where they live. I just saw that I had a skill set that not many other people had. I had experience in that area. I had I had lots of experience in maritime operations through that area. I had experience in marine biology. I'd seen all those places and documented them photographically. I could speak in a limited way some of the local languages. I had lots of contacts with the local people, and I just looked at it and thought, this is the pinnacle of coral reef biodiversity left on the earth. If we want to say, what is the big question, what is the area of reef it's most important to save, it's the Eastern Coral Triangle now. And I just thought, you know, we need to get proactive about doing marine conservation in there. It has to be at a grassroots level. We're going to have a vessel. We have to get around to these places. And so in 2017, I thought, okay, I'm approaching 50. Let's use this, you know, last 10 or 15 years of my working life while I'm still fit and able to dive and do all this stuff to get an organization together, a not-for-profit organization that can actually go and address some of these issues out in this really super important area. So that was the genesis sort of moment of the Coral Sea Foundation. And that's our objective, to raise awareness of this area. Firstly, to let people know that it's there, especially that it's right on Australia's northern doorstep. It's literally 2 days sail from Cairns. It's the northern arc of the Coral Sea. It's connected to the Great Barrier Reef via ocean currents and larval delivery. You know, if we're talking about managing this incredible reef system that's on our northern doorstep, it's not just the Great Barrier Reef. It's the Great Barrier Reef and PNG and the Solomons. The whole thing forms a unit. So there's lots of people working on the Great Barrier Reef. There's lots of government organisations. There's AIMS. There's lots of NGOs now. And in contrast, we've got this reef province to the north, just 15% more biodiverse, more complex, and there's just no work being done there, or very little. So I thought, you know, that's where I think I can best spend my time and utilise the skill set that I've got.
One of the really cool projects that is going on is the Sea Women of Melanesia. Do you want to give us a bit of a brief about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the genesis of that Sea Women program was a young woman that came up to me and said, you know, I want to study biology so that I can look after my local area. And, you know, it made me realise that there's a very large resource, not just in the young people of Melanesia, but particularly in the women. There's a very strong conservation ethic in Melanesian women. And yet they're not getting many opportunities to get involved in working in the sea. And the other important point, I guess, to back up what Naomi just said, the really crucial role of the sea women is being the advocates in the community for the marine conservation work. I mean, these marine reserves that we're trying to set up, they only work if the whole community can agree to modify their fishing pressure. So that's the message that we have to get across. We can go in there as foreigners into a village and explain in English all about the science and why it's beneficial to do that. But I've seen it happen numerous times now. If a local person, a local woman, or somebody that can speak the local language goes into these communities and explains the need for it, you see the light bulbs going off in people's heads. Again, coming up with the appropriate ways of getting that community engagement to happen is one of the things that we've been working at and looking for. I've been lucky enough to meet people from island communities all over Melanesia, and there's a huge diversity of communities, of people, of language groups. There's over 800 languages spoken in PNG alone. Getting that essential cultural information about who owns the reef, about what the traditional fishing practices were, whether there was any traditional closed areas or not, who had rights to fish where, what sort of animals were taken and when, all that information we need to know when we come into a place. And because of this cultural diversity, we can't hope to learn it in one area and then just apply it to a new area. We have to get that information in every new place that we go. And again, what we found is that Naomi and her team of women are very, very good at getting that information from the local people. And this is really what we're about, is the Coral Sea Foundation is really about empowering the local people in Melanesia to take the lead role in this marine conservation stuff, giving them the skills and the understanding and the equipment that they need to drive their own marine conservation program. We're lighting the fire. We're hoping that they keep it alight.
I think it's beautiful. I'm just giving empowerment to women. When it comes to caring and looking after things, women are just naturally in tune, you know, from, say, the moment of birth. You know, the first thing that we ever felt was our mum's touch. So I think that caring aspect and that real empathetic feeling comes across a lot better when you teach women. They can really have a better understanding.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the bigger issue is that there needs to be more engagement across the whole community in Melanesia to get these reserves to work. It's not just about empowering the women. But at the moment, women are not as heavily engaged in ocean work and marine conservation work as the men. So yes, it's about boosting the position of women, but then giving the support to the whole community to let the whole community rise up as one and let them see that it's that everyone needs to be involved to get these marine conservation things to work. But yeah, the thing in Melanesia that again people probably aren't aware of is that in different parts of Melanesia, there's either matrilineal tenure over the land or there's patrilineal tenure over the land. So in about half of Melanesia, the women traditionally owned the land. So you only owned land where your mother was from. Knowing and working out whether that's the case in the areas that we're working is really important, because in the societies where there's matrilineal tenure, there's automatically already a greater amount of respect and attention given to the opinions of the women. And so we've found in those areas where it's matrilineal tenure, it's very easy to get the women engaged. The men don't have any issue with the women being empowered to do the marine conservation work. In the areas where it's patrilineal tenure, we have to perhaps be a little bit more sensitive about how we bring that in, and we have to be a little bit more sensitive about how we engage the whole community. So understanding those differences, again, it's a complex web of cultural stuff going on in Melanesia that you have to understand before you can get these programs to work.
It sounds like not a minefield, but definitely a spider web, as into getting all the dynamics right, just so you don't unsettle anyone, and also you can really push your message across.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about the PNG reserves.
Yeah.
And you've just recently awarded or been awarded a grant, is that correct?
Yeah, we've had really good support from, I mean, a whole range of donors. I mean, I must point out that the whole of the effort of the Coral Sea Foundation to date has been a group effort by not only a large group of people, but also a really diverse network of people that have supported us either with direct funding, or material or gear or medical aid, that sort of thing. So far, by far our biggest donor and probably our most steadfast supporter has been the Unico Conservation Foundation. They funded us last year to help complete our Sea Women of Melanesia training programs in PNG and in the Solomons. And they've seen the benefit of what we started, and they've come through and helped us with a second round grant, which will basically provide all the material that we need to deliver our village-based and community-based conservation programs for at least through the next couple of months anyway, through the Milne province of PNG. So that's been really great to see that those guys understand what we're doing, and they sort of understand the vision and that they're prepared to get behind it and support it.
Okay, so let's touch on some ecotourism now. You've obviously been involved in ecotourism for a very long time. To you, what is the ultimate ecotourism experience?
Look, I think my experience has shown time and time and time again that when people are put in the right location with the right gear and the right guide, and they have the scientific information, the educational aspect of what they're seeing explained to them really clearly, it increases their appreciation of that environment immeasurably. I mean, that has been the most common bit of feedback I've had over a couple of decades of doing this work, was that, wow, Andy, the information that you provided, the insight that you gave us into what we were seeing, made all the difference in terms of our overall appreciation of what we're doing. In terms of Melanesia, to get out to these places, you need a vessel. There's no other way to get out there. I mean, you can fly out there in a helicopter if you're a billionaire, but even still, that's not going to help you get in the water. So you need a suitable expedition vessel to get out to these locations. So to enjoy that ecotourism experience, then, you know, you need to be comfortable on the boat. You need to have everything on the boat that you need. But I mean, in terms of the bigger picture, it's a little bit ironic if we're out there doing ecotourism, talking about saving the reef, but at the same time, we're burning massive amounts of carbon to get out there in a conventionally powered vessel. One of the visions that we had with the Coral Sea Foundation was to also ask the question, is it possible to design a vessel that will get us out to all these super important areas through this eastern coral triangle? But can we do that with a vessel that's mostly powered by renewable energy? And as well as having some of the best reefs in the world, the thing that the northern Coral Sea and that eastern arc of Papua New Guinea and the Solomons has is really abundant renewable energy resources. The wind resource alone is absolutely fantastic. It's one of the consistently windiest stretches of water around the Australian coast from about April all the way through to probably September or October. So that drove that initial concept towards a large sail-powered multi-hull vessel. So multi-hull for stability and speed, sail-powered to give us the ability to be sailing along at 12 or 15 knots, which is, you know, typical service speed for a motor-powered vessel. The other thing that we want to do with eco-tourism, of course, is to provide not just a sort of a sustainable source of income for the people in these communities, but give them small-scale industries and micro-businesses that they can be doing, again, on a sustainable level to produce income for their community. Like, a lot of people say to me, okay, is it in the best interest of the reefs and these local people that tourist vessels are coming into their area to see the reef? And my answer is always, it's much better than the alternative, which is no vessels coming and the local people being encouraged to sell off their fish and their clams and their logs and their rainforest to external foreign logging or mining companies, because that then leaves them without a long-term ecological base to support them. So one of the things we wanted to build into that large sailing catamaran design was the ability to use biofuel. And so the idea is that each one of our partner communities would have marine protected areas that we're helping them support, but we would also have coconut oil processing facilities in the villages. There's large numbers of coconut plantations all through these areas that we're working, that were planted just after the Second World War. So there's lots of coconuts that, in fact, the local people can't really use them. They're falling onto the ground. But we can produce coconut oil out of that. Coconut oil produces the best quality biodiesel of any plant substrate that we know. And so the idea was, on this vessel, we would have chemical conversion plant that would let us turn coconut oil into biodiesel, and then we could run, for example, our generators and our hybrid power system on that vessel with another renewable resource. So the whole world's moving in this way now. Everybody's starting to ask this question of, okay, how do we decarbonize whatever industry we're involved in? Expedition vessels doing ecotourism have just as much need to decarbonize as any other industry. The ace that we saw in the hole here was the Coral Sea is the most appropriate testbed to develop some of that stuff, because it has a great wind resource, it has a great biofuel resource, it's also got plenty of sun. So a vessel that can harness all those things can quite effectively move around its whole area of operations, just about running on renewable energy the whole time.
For sure. And that's a beautiful topic to segue towards. So let's talk renewable energies and why it's so important to Melanesia and the Coral Sea.
Well, look, I mean, in terms of the big picture, if you ask the question of, you know, what are the major threats to the Great Barrier Reef? What are the major threats to the Coral Triangle? The big one at the moment is what's happening with climate change and the fact that the oceans are warming, the alkalinity is dropping. And so, you know, the simple answer to address that question is, as many people have said, the fossil fuels need to stay in the ground. We need to get our emissions down and do it quickly. And every year that we're waiting means that the speed that those emissions reductions have to happen to limit us below a dangerous rise in temperature, the speed with which those emissions reductions have to happen is getting faster and faster. So, you know, in terms of the big picture of this area, encouraging people to move towards renewable energy, both for power generation, for transport, you name it, you know, that's one of the major things that we can be doing to help this situation now. And I mean, the irony I find is that Australia is blessed with the largest renewable energy resources of any country in the world. We have a first world economy. We've got a first world R&D sector. We should be and could be a world leader in renewable energy innovation, development and export. I mean, we have the potential, which is starting to be acted upon, to be exporting energy in the form of either electricity or hydrogen to our near neighbours. Mike Cannon-Brookes is really leading the charge on that with the Sun Cable, the new proposal to link a giant solar farm in the Northern Territory directly to Singapore by an underwater electricity cable. And there's, you know, a lot of our major resource companies, Woodside, amongst others, are starting to look very seriously now at converting their LNG export facilities over to hydrogen export facilities. The demand for hydrogen is already high and is going to skyrocket in Southeast Asia over the next couple of decades. So there's a golden opportunity waiting there for Australia. Renewable energy is now cheaper than any fossil fuel energy. So it makes economic sense, it makes environmental sense, it makes sense from our perspective, in terms of the prosperity of our nation, we just need to be doing it, and we need to be moving in that way. And, you know, the major logjam in that system at the moment is the political one. There's no technological barriers to it. It's just really, it's a political situation that we need to change now.
Let's get to the nitty gritty. Why do you think there's so much pushback on the new, on renewable resources? And why do you think the people are just grabbing on fossil fuels and still using them?
Oh, it's quite clear that there's deeply entrenched connections between most of the senior elements of the government with the fossil fuel industry. I'd encourage people to have a look at the video piece that Michael West put out late last year, which clearly showed the links between virtually the whole upper echelon of the Liberal National Party and the coal industry. It's a simple case of vested interest in the fossil fuel industry being protected. And, you know, massive donations are made to our political parties from those industries. People probably look at it and go, okay, well, that's the way we've always done things. I'm a little bit nervous about what change means. But I think this summer of fire in Australia now is going to be an absolute watershed moment now, because we've had our major eastern and southeastern Australian cities, millions and millions of people, probably at least half of our population, have directly now experienced climate change related impacts. I mean, let's be absolutely clear. We're at the end of an unprecedented drought. The whole of southeast Australia is hotter and drier than it has been any time in our instrumental record. Lo and behold, bushfires start in September and burn greater amounts of area than we've ever seen before. I mean, if you don't get that, then you're not opening your eyes. So, and I think the majority of Australians now get that. And I imagine at the next election there is going to be some serious change in Australia, because now you can't avoid it as being one of the big issues. And it has been shown as a big issue through polling for a number of years. It just hasn't yet translated over into that political change, but we're very hopeful that that's going to change in the next couple of years.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's almost a poison mentality that Australians have. It's almost this blind faith that whatever's happening around them in terms of government, in terms of policy, is the right thing to do. And people just don't dive into it, and they assume everything's fine because they live in a nice, comfy house and in air conditioning, and they just assume everything's fine because they don't feel like it's affecting them. And I think that that's a real danger for Australia itself, to have too much reliance and too much trust on a higher power and not ask questions. It's a great deal. It's a great thing to do, to ask these questions. You know, is this the right thing we're doing? Am I being led on by someone? And what's going on around me? And then try to link that all together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, people need to understand that the whole globe now is in the middle of the biggest transition in energy since motor cars replaces horses and carts. I mean, that's the magnitude of the scale of the transition we're in at the moment. Renewables are now cheaper across the board. So if you want to generate power now, the cheapest way to do it is with renewable energy, including storage. It's now cheaper than coal, it's cheaper than gas, it's cheaper than any other form of generating electricity. So even if you put the climate change thing aside, the economics of it now are absolutely unstoppable. If you look into the divestment that's going on, you know, some of the biggest corporations in the world, some of the biggest fund managers in the world now, responsible for portfolios valued in the tens of trillions of dollars, are moving out of fossil fuels because they see that its time is up, and that they see now that the new advantages and the new prosperity is going to be in renewables. I just think we need to be on that train, and we could be leading the world in that department. I think it makes no sense at all to be clinging on to the past. You know, it's like the guy saying, okay, well, we know we're going to stick with making horseshoes and saddles and our investments in providing horse feed while everybody else was moving to motor cars. Or somebody saying, we're going to stick with our investment in typewriters when everyone else was moving to laptops and word processors. It doesn't make sense. And I don't want to see Australia left behind the rest of the world. And I just think we have so much more potential as a country and as a nation than being just a quarry for Southeast Asia, which is pretty well what we're doing at the moment.
Okay, so we've touched on renewable energy, which is obviously a really important subject, but now let's filter down to everyday life. What can everyday person do to have less of an impact? One, on climate change and the global warming, and two, on the reef?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the two very simple things we need to do to give coral reefs a future is that we need to get our emissions down, our carbon emissions down, and we need to create more marine reserves. They're the only two things that are going to give coral reefs at a large scale a future. So in terms of what the average person can do, there's lots of stuff you can do to get your emissions down. Practical things you can do around your own house, just in terms of lowering your energy use, obviously, in terms of your transport, your vehicles, and the amount of resources that you're consuming. But as we just touched on, the big thing that people can do is use their vote to vote for the change in the political system that we need that will start to accelerate the transition to renewable energy. I mean, that's probably one of the most important things that people can do. I mean, I hear a lot of people say, okay, well, I'm stuck in this system. I've got a car, you know, I've got air conditioning in the house. We have to buy our power. We have to buy our fuel. There is no alternative. Pushing for the political change, which will bring those alternatives into being, is absolutely essential. Because without those, we're stuck with our noses in the fossil fuel trough. And in terms of marine protected areas, I mean, the main thing people can do is make themselves aware that there is a need for marine protected areas. We need roughly 30% of all the marine habitats in the world protected. We aren't near that yet. So, you know, when people are hearing about initiatives to have those marine protected areas in place, then they should support those and understand that they're necessary. You know, I think there's a lot of misconception, particularly amongst the fishing community in Australia, that somehow locking away bits of our coastal infrastructure into marine reserves is somehow negatively affecting their fishing. Whereas all the science shows marine reserves produce many more offspring and the actual overall fisheries productivity is improved if we have 30% or 35% of the marine area protected. So awareness of that and people get involved. There's lots of citizen science projects that things people can do now, either via the web. There's lots of amazing websites now that you can use to either educate yourself or you can actually see what it looks like underwater. Incredible video. I mean, the Underwater Earth people have got the Google Street View that works underwater. I mean, you can literally pan around and look at what the reef looked like in the areas that those people were diving. So there's lots of ways that you can educate yourselves and get a little bit more interested in what's going on out there. But getting your own energy use and emissions down and pushing for that political change that we need so that as a nation, we can get our emissions down and accelerate that transition to renewable energy. That's the big one at the moment, not just to save the reef, but to give our whole country a future. You know, and people will say, oh, you know, I've heard this argument. Oh, we're just such a small country. It doesn't matter what we do. The point is leadership. You know, we have an opportunity to be a global leader in this stuff. If we show leadership, other countries follow. At the moment, we're not showing leadership. We're sitting down the back of the pack trying to trip everybody else over in their ambitions to lower emissions. As the country with the best renewable energy resources in the world, we should be the leader, showing people how to do it, developing the technology that can then be exported to their countries, helping them with it, exporting our hydrogen to them. That's the position that we need to be in. And that's something that is only going to come through large segments of the Australian population voting for elected members that understand that and are going to drive that forward.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of great points that you bring up there, and we'll just backtrack about 2 minutes. But the whole idea of fishing zones and just green zones where you just let be, it's a great way to develop fisheries and ensure that there is fish for the future. And if anyone wants to look up a really brilliant example of that, it's the Pornite Islands in New Zealand. They are just the absolute blueprint for marine reserves. I think they were one of the early ones or even the first ones that created. And the research that's come off that and the sort of example that's led to a really good one to look at. And the other one is so you're reducing your emissions and having some sort of awareness of what's going on around you. There are options out there. There are choices. There are better choices that you can make. So yeah, don't stick your head in the sand. All right, so my next question just relates to the next generation. So you've got 4 kids and they're obviously going to grow up and experience the world and you want them to experience the same things that you grew up as, beautiful coral reefs, nice natural environments. What sort of message do you pass on to them to engage with the natural environment and to be aware of what's going on as well?
Well, that is a big part of the reason that we've lived over on here on Magnetic Island for the last 20 years. I really wanted all my kids to grow up in an environment where the bush and the reef and the beach was close by and it was something that they could just interact with on a daily basis, and through that interaction develop that deep understanding of the beauty of nature, the importance of nature, how it makes you feel being immersed in nature, and the fact that it's an important resource to have for the future. But I mean, look, I don't pull any punches with my kids. I let them know very clearly that unfortunately, the world they're going to be living in when they're 30 or 40 is not the same as the world that I lived in when I'm 30 or 40. And I really reinforce to them that based on where they've grown up and the knowledge that they've got from having parents that have studied science and marine science and anthropology, that they in turn need to be the advocates in their generation for continuing to push for the change that we need to see. Because, you know, these issues we're facing now, they're going to be going on for another few centuries. I mean, the changes in temperature, the changes in ice mass, the changes in CO2 that we've set in train are not going to stop anytime soon. It's about a question of how high they go before they plateau and then when we bring them down. But it's a multi-century timescale that we're looking at now. So these issues of sustainability of our civilization, of our human race, those issues aren't going away anytime soon. So every generation now for the next 10, 20 generations is going to need to be concerned about that and take those issues on. So giving them the information to be advocates in that way is something that I see is my role as a parent. But yeah, look, I've tried to do my best to immerse them in those areas. All the kids have been up to Papua New Guinea. My two daughters lived with us in the Solomon Islands for 3 months in a traditional village. They, you know, no power. They went to school in a traditional Solomon Islands school. They saw how our near neighbours are living. And the fact that right on our northern doorstep is this incredible archipelago of islands and jungle and seas and reefs and waterfalls, but people are still living in houses made out of sticks and leaves. Kids get a simple illness that would be cured in Australia by one trip to the doctor, and the kids in Melanesia die because they've got no access to the medical aid that we have. So I think it's important that how the other half lives was exposed to them in these formative years of their lives.
Beautiful message to put on, and just some amazing wisdom to show your kids that there is a world outside of your little 20-kilometre radius. I think a lot of people live in that bubble, and they don't get that exposure, and it's almost like being stuck in your own head. You don't understand that there are issues out there, and not everyone, say, has it as well or as good as you, and there are also things that you can do about it. You know, if you decide to take action, if you make better choices than your current situation, then yeah, you're going to leave the world in a better place than you started. In terms of, say, a budding marine biologist that's coming up, what sort of message would you pass on to them?
Look, I think no matter what field you're in, whether you're in marine biology or whatever it is, the first thing that you have to understand is that your success in that field is going to be based on your passion and your persistence and your ability to keep working in that field and not give up. You know, I mean, I think that's the most important characteristic. I mean, everybody, certainly in marine biology that I've seen that's been successful and it has enjoyed it and it has made a career out of it, they're passionate about it, they're prepared to work hard at it. And, you know, I would say to people that are coming up and considering marine biology, have a good think about what it really is that you want to be doing. If you think marine biology is sort of a sexy thing to get into because you love dolphins and turtles and, you know, you like the idea of cruising around in the tropics and hanging out on a white sand beach with coconuts, that it's not always going to be like that. A lot of the time it's rough. A lot of the time you're going to get seasick. A lot of the time you're going to be diving multiple hours a day until you're so sick of breathing compressed air that, you know, you just want to do anything else. But that is part of the life. But if it's something that you're really passionate about, then you need to follow that. You need to follow that dream. And, you know, that's the path I went down, and that's the path of most other people that, you know, in my cohort that have been successful in their careers in marine science have done. They've been very, very dedicated in following that work.
Okay, so let's dive into the Papua New Guinea Marine Conservation Initiative. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The PNG Marine Conservation Initiative is a collaboration between the Coral Sea Foundation and two partner businesses, both of which are responsible for guiding independent yachts through Papua New Guinea and Melanesia. So one of our partners is Angela Penafala from Melanesian Luxury Yacht Services. She's a Papua New Guinean woman, and also Craig DeWitt from PNG Yacht Services. Between the two of them, they've spent decades working in PNG. We've had many years of contact and discussion about what we can do to support the local people, both in terms of a humanitarian support and supporting them with developing marine reserves, which are going to support the ecotourism. Between them, Craig and Angela handle, for example, most of the super yachts that are coming into PNG. The super yacht numbers are building at about 30 or 40% per year at the moment. And so that's one of the funding models that we're able to draw on, is to be able to say to the owners and the clients that are on these vessels to say, hey, okay, if you want to come here and see these beautiful reefs that you can dive on and these lovely villages and everything, then we need to be being a little bit more proactive about looking after them, because otherwise they're going to get slowly fished out and degraded. And the quality of that asset that you want to see it as an ecotourism visitor is going to decline. We've been talking about how to sort of formalize that and harness that initiative for quite some time, probably since the formation of the Coral Sea Foundation. And so late last year, we decided to, the three organizations, to work collaboratively and really push the thing forward. Craig is the owner of a beautiful 24 meter dive vessel, the Golden Dawn, which has been one of PNG's premier liveaboard dive vessels for probably the last 20 years. And through his work on that, he was able to also get an incredible understanding of the different areas of PNG and the connections with the local people in the reefs, just as Angela has through her work. Craig has made the Golden Dawn available to us at cost to be used in this conservation work. So that's that was an incredible windfall. We now have a vessel. We've got a team of people that can run that vessel. We've got Naomi and the sea women that are going to be on those expeditions and training the local people, women and men, in each of those areas that we go to. We've now got the means of getting our humanitarian aid out into these villages, getting our scientists out into these villages, and helping the local people get their marine reserves in place. On the one hand, getting the marine reserve in place relies on the local community modifying their fishing pressure. But it's also important that those marine reserves are officially recognised by the Papua New Guinean government. And that's what the local people need a bit of a hand with, because we need to submit a marine reserve management plan. It has to set out all the technical details of what's in that reserve, you know, who owns it, what the rules are of the reserve. So in a lot of these villages, there's no electricity, there's no power. I mean, so for us to be able to go there with a vessel and be able to get all the local people together and say, okay, this is what it needs to have. You guys give us that information. We're going to help you get all that information together and submit it to the government. So having the vessel, having the team of people that understand what needs to be done, really gives us a way of practically and pragmatically getting these things moving forward at the village level and then also at the government level. And it's a good size. You know, a lot of conservation organisations, in my opinion, get too big and they get overbloated, and then most of their funding ends up going on admin. So, I mean, that's one of the things that we're aiming to do, is to keep it streamlined, keep it professional and keep it efficient, so that we can get the work done that we need to get done without getting bogged down in too much red tape and bureaucracy.
And I suppose your biggest cost there would be obviously the vessel itself and then employing researchers or marine biologists to come across. Would that be fair to say?
The biggest cost, no doubt. I mean, running a vessel is a big cost. Getting out, getting people onto the vessel and providing the humanitarian aid for the villages. I mean, this is, you know, our model relies on supporting the villages with clean water infrastructure, with medical aid, and with educational materials for their schools. So that's what we're, and with the support to help them get the marine reserves registered. So that's what we're offering to the local people in return for them deciding that yes, it's a good idea to put an area of reef near a marine reserve, and then, you know, we help them do that. I mean, most of the scientists that want to come and join the expedition probably can fund themselves to get out to the boat. I mean, we are still a not-for-profit organisation. We're a charitable organisation. So we're, you know, raising funds is constantly something that we needed to be doing. But the idea is that we would have on that vessel in each expedition, we would have scientists that can do the reef surveys. We would have a Naomi and other Indigenous representatives on board that can help do the training. We would have representatives from the PNG government conservation organisations. We would also like to have a medic on board, a doctor or a nurse.
Where do you see the future of the whole industry going? Do you feel like it's got a lot of room for growth, as in you were saying that the industry, superyacht industry, is growing by 30 to 40%, assuming that's boats per year? Do you feel like that's going to potentially have a negative impact on the corals, or is it just going to bring sort of more people into the area with money, and then you sort of guide them towards the more sustainable options and looking after the reef?
Yeah, look, I mean, the big threat to the Eastern Coral Triangle, to PNG and the Solomons at the moment, is not through tourism. The big, big threat is extraction of marine resources and terrestrial resources, primarily by foreign fishing or mining or logging companies. You know, that's the big one. I mean, Solomon Islands, the whole place has been logged probably three or four times since the 1980s. Same in Papua New Guinea. I mean, there's logging companies working in there. There are fishing companies working in there. And you've probably heard of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, China has its eyes very strongly focused on Papua New Guinea. They would love to have the fish resources. They would love to have the timber, the shark fin, the sea cucumber. So that's what's being dangled in front of the local people at the moment, short-term gain for exploiting their natural resources. So anything that we can do to provide them with sustainable income, and let's be clear, a super yacht coming in and visiting a village leaves virtually no impact. We don't anchor on the coral. The people dive around the reef. They don't damage the coral. By and large, we leave. We pay for our anchorage and we pay for any activities we do. We donate humanitarian aid into the village. And we encourage the local people to think about marine conservation. So ecotourism, vessel visitation to these places is, in my opinion, is a massive win-win. What we really need to get going, though, is small-scale homestay ecotourism sort of stuff happening. You know, Papua New Guinea shouldn't be a destination only for billionaires to come on their super yachts. It needs to be a place that everyone in Australia that wants to stick a backpack on their back can fly in, get out to these villages and spend a week in a traditional area, much like has happened in Fiji. You know, that's what I'm saying to people in PNG constantly is look at Fiji. Fiji's whole economy runs primarily off of tourism. They're not logging their forests. They're not developing huge mines. And they've got a successful economy based on people coming there and staying. We need to get that happening in PNG and the Solomons. But to do that, we need to improve the eco situation and we need to improve the security situation. And it's slowly happening. But look, in my opinion, if anyone from the Australian government's listening, we need to be doing a lot more to help our neighbours in Papua New Guinea. And some of the aid that's going there needs to be better directed, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Fiji because I think that's a great example of how the sort of tropical island paradise can be sold towards tourism. And people want that. They see, you know, coconuts, sandy beaches, clear water, and it's just a dream. So, yeah, a lot of tourism is based towards Fiji. I think the saddest thing about Fiji is probably Fiji water. I think that's their biggest biggest drive for their economy. I think it's either tourism or Fiji water. I can't remember who comes first. But I think that's something I'd like to touch on, if you don't mind, just plastics in the ocean. And what are your experiences traveling through Melanesia? Have you seen much plastic in the ocean? Is it a problem?
Yeah, look, if you're near a major population centre or a village, yes, then you'll see some plastic pollution in the water. But I mean, let's be clear, the difference between Melanesia and Indonesia and Southeast Asia is it's just chalk and cheese. I mean, I would confidently say there's probably 100 times more plastic in the water in Indonesia than there is in PNG and the Solomons at the moment. That's the biggest area of problem that we need to be addressing, the fact that, you know, major population centres with millions of people on them in Indonesia are still just dumping all their rubbish straight into the sea. And a lot of that is, especially up in the northern Bismarck Sea, is blowing west in the monsoon and ending up on the beaches of those beautiful islands in PNG. And so one of the initiatives that we've actually got going is we're partnering with a New Zealand-based business called Blended Fuel Solutions. And they have come up with a basic plastic pyrolysis transformation unit. So it's a small unit that can be installed in a village. It takes any sort of plastic rubbish that the locals can find on the beach and it melts it in the absence of oxygen, breaks it down into cooking gas and also into a liquid hydrocarbon that they can burn through a rocket stove to use for cooking. So we saw a demonstration unit running in Munda when we were there last year. And they were running all the kitchen for the local church was running off of basically old plastic bottles and plastic bags that the kids were collecting in the street. So we're going to get a few of those units deployed out in the western part of the Bismarck Sea later in the year. And again, if people are interested in doing something about the plastic problem in that part of the world, then you know we'd love the support to purchase those units and then install them in the villages. At the moment, we're looking at probably getting three or four and getting them out there because some of these beaches are, they're, you know, literally almost knee deep in Asian plastic pollution. And so the two options are you either gather it all up, put it in a barge and ship it back to a landfill somewhere, or we can actually use it to cook with, and then they don't need to bring gas out in gas bottles, again, in their longboats from a long way away. So
that's amazing. Never heard of that before.
And yeah, yeah. It's worth checking out. Blended Fuel Solutions, NZ, BFS, NZ.net. Very, very cool guys, backyard inventors, chemical engineers, biofuel innovators. So there's lots of things like that that can be done. But yeah, look, I mean, on the Great Barrier Reef and PNG, no, there's not a huge amount of plastic pollution. There's some, but compared to Indonesia, where in some places you can't even drive a boat across a harbour without wrapping tons of plastic bags around your outboard, it's not as serious.
Yeah, okay. Well, great insight to have. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me in this home surrounded by jungle. It's been a great experience. I've heard the birds calling outside and sweating hot. I don't know what it must be, 32 degrees in here at the moment. But yeah, thank you so much for having me on board.
It's our pleasure, Josh. And to all the listeners, yeah, look, stay in touch with us. We've got an active presence on social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and we're going to be going to some incredible places over the next 12 months. And, you know, part of what we want to do is to bring people along for that ride so that they can get an idea of the places and the people and the importance of the work that we're doing out there. So there's going to be lots of incredible footage and imagery coming out of our expeditions. We do have volunteer places on board that vessel. So I mean, if people are interested in joining that, our expeditions, or they have a particular skill set that would be useful, then please get in touch with us. Check us out on the net, coralseafoundation.net. And we would love your support in raising awareness of what we're doing, raising people's awareness of the organisation, and just raising people's awareness of the importance of these reefs. And, you know, as we've got on the T-shirts, they're too precious to lose.
100% agree, mate. I mean, what you're doing is fantastic. You're such a passionate person. I can just feel the energy radiating off you, and I really appreciate your time, and just kudos for what you're doing. It's really fantastic work.
Thanks, Josh.
Be sure to follow us at The Oceans Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And if you'd like to get in contact, send us an email at theoceanspodcast@gmail.com. Lastly, be sure to check out Take 3 for the Sea to find out how you can help and have a positive impact on our oceans. That's take3.org. So that's about it for another episode of The Oceans Podcast. If you like what you heard, then please hit the like and subscribe button, share with your family and friends, and don't forget to go over to the Coral Sea Foundation website to check them out. And also check out their stuff on Facebook and Instagram. It's pretty amazing sort of stuff what they're doing. So until next time, go get salty, pick up that piece of plastic in the ocean, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Oceans Podcast.